As he sank onto the bench in the dock, he lifted his head and searched the gallery of the court. There was a pathetic anxiety in his expression as he ran his eyes swiftly over the packed benches. Then Santayne saw the little flare of joy in his eyes and his masked smile as he found what he was seeking. She had watched this scene enacted every morning for 5 days, and she twisted in her seat and looked up at the gallery behind her. But from where she sat, the angle was wrong. She could not see who or what had attracted Lothar's attention. "Silence in court!" the usher called, and there was a shuffling and scrabbling as the body of the court came to its feet, and Judge Hawthorne led his two assessors to their seats. He was a silver-haired little man with a benign expression and lively, sparkling eyes behind his pince-nez. He looked more like a schoolmaster than the hanging judge that A.B. said he was.
Neither he nor his assessors wore wigs or the colourful robes of the English courts. Roman Dutch law was more sombre in its trappings. They wore simple black gowns and white swallow-tailed neckties, and the three of them conferred quietly, inclining their heads together while the body of the court settled down, and the coughing and throat-clearing and foot-shuffling abated. Then Judge Hawthorne looked up and went through the formality of convening the court, and the charge sheet was read over once again. Now an expectant hush fell over the courtroom. The reporters leaned forward with their notebooks poised. Even the barristers in the front row of benches were silenced and stilled. Lothar was expressionless but deathly pale as he watched the judge's face. Judge Hawthorne was concentrating on his notes, heightening the tension with subtle showmanship until it was barely supportable. Then he looked up brightly and launched without preliminaries into the delivery of his summation and judgment. First he detailed each of the charges, beginning with the most serious. 3 counts of attempted murder, 2 of assault with intent to inflict grievous bodily harm, 1 of armed robbery. There were 26 charges in all, and it took almost 20 minutes for the judge to cover each of them. The prosecution has presented all these charges in an orderly and convincing manner. The red-faced prosecutor preened at the compliment, and Santayne felt an unreasonable irritation at this petty vanity. The judge went on. This court was particularly impressed with the evidence of the main prosecution witnesses. His Excellency, the administrator's testimony, was a great help to me and my assessors. We were most fortunate in having a witness of this calibre to relate the details of the pursuit and arrest of the accused, from which arise some of the most serious charges in this case. The judge looked up from his notes, directly at Blaine Malcolmus. I wish to record the most favourable impression that Colonel Malcolmus made upon this court, and we have accepted his evidence without reservation. From where she was sitting, Santayne could see the back of Blaine's head. The tips of his large ears turned pink as the judge looked at him, and Santayne felt a rush of tenderness as she noticed. His embarrassment was somehow endearing and touching. Then the judge looked at her. The other prosecution witness, who conducted herself impeccably and whose evidence was unimpeachable, was Mrs. Santayne Courtney. The court is fully aware of the great hardship with which Mrs. Courtney had been inflicted and the courage which she has displayed, not only in this courtroom. Once again, we were most fortunate to have the benefit of her evidence in assisting us to reach our verdict. While the judge was speaking, Lothar de la Rey turned his head and looked at Santayne steadily. Those pale, accusing eyes disconcerted her, and she dropped her own gaze to the handbag in her lap to avoid them. The judge went on. In contrast, the defence was able to call only one witness, and that was the accused himself.
After due consideration, we are of the opinion that much of the accused evidence was unacceptable. The witness's attitude was at times hostile and uncooperative. In particular, we reject the witness's assertion that the offences were committed single-handed and that he had no accomplices in their commission. Here the evidence of Colonel Malcolmus, of Mrs. Courtney, and of the police troopers is unequivocal and collaborative. Lothar de la Rey turned his head slowly in the judge's direction once more, and stared at him with that flat, hostile expression which had so antagonized Judge Hawthorne over the 5 long days of the trial. And the judge returned his gaze levelly as he went on. "Thus we have considered all the facts and the evidence presented to us, and are unanimous in our verdict. On all 26 charges, we find the accused, Lothar de la Rey, guilty as charged." Lothar neither flinched nor blinked, but there was a concerted gasp from the body of the court, followed immediately by a buzz of comment. 3 of the reporters leapt up and scampered from the courtroom, and A.B. nodded smugly beside Santaine. "I told you, the rope," he murmured. "He will swing for sure." The ushers were attempting to restore order. The judge came to their assistance. He rapped his gavel sharply and raised his voice. "I will not hesitate to have this court cleared," he warned, and once again a hush settled over the courtroom. "Before passing sentence, I will listen to any submissions in mitigation that the defence may wish to put to the bench." Judge Hawthorne inclined his head towards the young barrister charged with the defence, who immediately rose to his feet. Lothar de la Rey was destitute and unable to afford his own defence. Mr. Reginald Osmond had been appointed by the court to defend him. Despite his youth and inexperience, it was his first defence on a capital charge, Osmond had thus far acquitted himself as well as could have been expected, given the hopeless circumstances of his client's case. His cross-examination had been spirited and nimble, if ineffectual, and he had not allowed the prosecution to make any gratuitous gains. He said, "If it please my lord, I should like to call a witness to give evidence in mitigation." "Come now, Mr. Osmond," said the judge. "Surely you don't intend to introduce a witness at this stage? Do you have any precedents for this?" The judge frowned. Osmond replied, "I respectfully commend your lordship to the matter of the Crown versus Van der Spuy, 1923, and to the Crown versus Alexander, 1914. The judge conferred for a few moments with his assessors and then looked up with a stagey sigh of exasperation. "Very well, Mr. Osmond, I am going to allow you your witness." "Thank you, my lord." Mr. Osmond was so overcome with his own success that he stuttered a little as he blurted eagerly, "I could call Mrs. Santaine de Thierry Courtney to the stand." This time there was a stunned silence. Even Judge Hawthorne fell back in his tall carved chair before a buzz of surprise and delight and anticipation swept through the court. The press were standing to get a view of Santaine as she rose, and from the gallery a voice called, "Put the noose around the bastard's neck, love!" Judge Hawthorne recovered swiftly, and his eyes flashed behind his pince-nez as he glared up at the gallery, trying to identify the wag. "I will not tolerate a further outburst. There are severe penalties for contempt of court," he snapped, and even the journalists sat down again hurriedly, and chastened applied themselves to their notepads. The usher handed Santaine into the witness stand and then swore her, while every man in the room, including those on the bench, watched, most of them in open admiration, but a few, including Blaine and Abraham Abrahams, with puzzlement and perturbation. Mr. Osmond stood to open his examination, his voice pitched low with nervous respect. Mrs. Courtney, will you please tell the court how long you have known the accused? He corrected himself hurriedly, for now Lothar de la Rey was no longer merely accused. He had been convicted. The prisoner. I have known Lothar de la Rey for nearly 14 years. Santaine looked across the room at the stooped grey figure in the dock. Would you be good enough to describe in your own words the circumstances of your first meeting? It was in 1919. I was lost in the desert. I had been a castaway on the Skeleton Coast after the sinking of the Protea Castle. For a year and a half, I had been wandering in the Kalahari Desert with a small group of San Bushmen. All of them knew the story. At the time, it had been a sensation. But now, Santaine's narrative, related in her French accent, brought it all vividly to life. She conjured up the desolation and misery, the fearful hardships and loneliness that she had endured, and the room was deathly quiet. Even Judge Hawthorne was hunched down in his chair, supporting his chin on his clenched fist, absolutely still as he listened. They were all with her, as she struggled through the clinging sand of the Kalahari, dressed in the skins of wild animals, her infant son on her hip, following the tracks of a horse, a shod horse, the first sign of civilized man that she had encountered in all those desperate months. They chilled with her and shared her despair as the African night fell across the desert and her chances of succor receded. They willed her onwards through the darkness, seeking the glow of a campfire far ahead, then started in horror as she described the sinister shape, dark with menace, that suddenly confronted her, and flinched as though they also had heard the roar of a hungry lion close at hand. Her audience gasped and stirred as she described her fight for her life and the life of her infant. The way the circling lion drove her up into the highest branches of a tall mapani, and then climbed up towards her like a cat after a sparrow. Santaine described the sound of its hot, panting breath in the darkness, and at last the shooting agony as the long yellow claws hooked into the flesh of her leg, and she was drawn inexorably from her perch. She could not go on, and Mr. Osmond prompted her gently. Was it at this stage that Lothar de la Rey intervened? Santaine roused herself. I'm sorry, it all came back to me. Please, Mrs. Courtney, do not tax yourself. Judge Hawthorne rushed to her aid. I will recess the court if you need time. No, no, my lord. You are very kind, but that won't be necessary, she said. And she squared her shoulders and faced them again. Yes, that was when Lothar de la Rey came up. He had been camped close at hand and was alerted by the roars of the animal. He shot the lion dead while it was in the act of savaging me. He saved your life, Mrs. Courtney, said Osmond. He saved me from a dreadful death, and he saved my child with me. Mr. Osmond bowed his head in silence, letting the court savour the full drama of the moment. And then he asked gently, What happened after that, madam? I was concussed by my fall from the tree, the wound in my leg mortified. I was unconscious for many days, unable to care for myself or my son. And what was the prisoner's reaction to this? Asked Osmond. He cared for me. He dressed my wounds, tended every need of mine and of my child. He saved your life a second time.
Yes, she nodded. He saved me once again.
Now, Mrs. Courtney, the years passed. You became a wealthy lady, a millionairess.
Santaine was silent, and Osmond went on. Then one day, 3 years ago, the prisoner approached you for financial assistance for his fishing and canning enterprise. Is that correct?
He approached my company, said Santaine, Courtney Mining and Finance, for a loan.
Osmond then led her through the series of events up to the time that she had closed down Lowther's canning factory.
So, Mrs. Courtney, he finished, would you say that Lowther de la Rey had reason to believe that he had been unfairly treated, if not deliberately ruined, by your action?
Santaine hesitated.
My actions were at all times based on sound business principles. However, I would readily concede that, from Lowther de la Rey's standpoint, it could have seemed that my actions were deliberate.
At the time, did he accuse you of attempting to destroy him? Osmond asked. She looked down at her hands and whispered something.
I am sorry, Mrs. Courtney. I must ask you to repeat that.
And she flared at him, her voice cracking with strain.
Yes, damn it! He said I was doing it to destroy him.
Mr. Osmond, the judge sat up straight, his expression severe. I must insist that you treat your witness in a more considerate fashion. He sank back in his seat, clearly moved by Santaine's recital, and then raised his voice again.
I will recess the court for 15 minutes to allow Mrs. Courtney time to recover herself.
When they reconvened, Santaine entered the witness stand again and sat quietly while the formalities were completed and Mr. Osmond prepared to continue his examination. From the third row, Blaine Malcolmus smiled at her encouragingly, and she knew that if she did not look away from him, every single person in the courtroom would be aware of her feelings. She forced herself to break contact with his eyes and instead looked up at the gallery above his head. It was an idle glance. She had forgotten the way in which Lowther de la Rey searched the gallery each morning, but now she was seeing it from the same angle as he did from the dock. And suddenly her eyes flicked to the furthest corner of the gallery, drawn irresistibly by another set of eyes, by the intensity of a glowering gaze that was fastened upon her, and she started and then swayed in her seat, giddy with shock. For she had stared once again into Lowther's eyes. Lowther's eyes as they had been when first she met him, yellow as topaz, fierce and bright, with dark brows arched over them. Young eyes, unforgettable, unforgotten eyes. But the eyes were not set in Lowther's face, for Lowther sat across the courtroom from her, bowed and broken and grey. This face was young, strong and full of hatred, and she knew with a mother's sure instinct. She had never seen her younger son. At her insistence, he had been taken away, wet from the womb, at the very moment of birth, and she had turned her head away so as not to see his squirming, naked body. But now she knew him. And it was as though the very core of her existence, the womb which had contained him, ached at this glimpse of his face, and she had to cover her mouth to prevent herself crying out with the pain of it.
Mrs. Courtney! Mrs. Courtney!
The judge was calling her, his tone quickening with alarm, and she forced herself to turn her head towards him.
Are you all right, Mrs. Courtney? Are you feeling well enough to continue?
Thank you, my lord. I am quite well.
Her voice seemed to come from a great distance, and it took all her willpower not to look back at the youth in the gallery, at her son, Manfred.
"Very well, Mr. Osmond, you may proceed."
It required an enormous effort of will for Santaine to concentrate on the questions, as Osmond led her once more over the robbery and the struggle in the dry river bed.
"So then, Mrs. Courtney, he did not lay a finger upon you until you attempted to reach the shotgun?"
"No," said Santaine. "He did not touch me until then."
"You have already told us that you had the shotgun in your hand and were attempting to reload the weapon."
"That is correct."
"Would you have used the weapon if you had succeeded in reloading it?"
"Yes."
"Can you tell us, Mrs. Courtney, would you have shot to kill?"
"I object, my lord."
The prosecutor sprang angrily to his feet.
"That question is hypothetical."
"Mrs. Courtney, you do not have to answer that question if you do not choose," Judge Hawthorne told her.
"I will answer," Santaine said clearly.
"Yes, I would have killed him."
"Do you think the prisoner knew that?" asked the judge.
"My lord, I object," said the prosecutor. "The witness cannot possibly know."
Before the judge could rule, Santaine said clearly,
"He knew me. He knew me well. He knew I would kill him if I had the chance."
The pent-up emotion of the courtroom exploded in ghoulish relish, and it was almost a minute before quiet could be restored. In the confusion, Santaine looked up at the corner of the high gallery again. It had taken all her self-control not to do so before. The corner seat was empty. Manfred had gone, and she felt confused by his desertion. Osmond was questioning her again, and she turned to him vaguely.
"I'm sorry. Will you repeat that, please?"
"I asked, Mrs. Courtney, if the prisoner's assault on you, as you stood there with a shotgun in your hands intent on killing him..."
"My lord, I object. The witness was intent only on defending herself and her property," the prosecutor howled.
"You'll have to rephrase that question, Mr. Osmond," said the judge.
"Very well, my lord.
Mrs. Courtney, was the force that the prisoner used against you inconsistent with that needed to disarm you?"
"I'm sorry."
Santaine could not concentrate. She wanted to search the gallery again.
"I don't understand the question," she said.
"Did the prisoner use more force than that necessary to disarm you and prevent you shooting him?"
"No.
He simply pulled the shotgun away from me."
"And later, when you had bitten his wrist,
when you had buried your teeth in his flesh, inflicting a wound that later would result in the amputation of his arm, did he strike you or inflict any other injury upon you in retaliation?"
"No."
"The pain must have been intense, and yet he did not use undue force upon you?"
"No."
She shook her head.
"He was..."
Santaine searched for the word.
"He was strangely considerate, almost gentle."
"I see. And before he left you, did the prisoner make sure that you had sufficient water for survival? And did he give you advice concerning your well-being?"
"He checked that I had sufficient spare water, and he advised me to stay with the wrecked vehicle until I was rescued."
"Now, Mrs. Courtney," Osmond hesitated delicately,
"there has been speculation in the press that the prisoner might have made some form of indecent assault
Santaine interrupted him furiously. That suggestion is repugnant and totally false.
Thank you, madam. I have only one more question. You knew the prisoner well. You accompanied him while he was hunting to provide meat for you and your child once he had rescued you. You saw him shoot.
I did, said Santaine.
In your opinion, if the prisoner had wanted to kill you or Colonel Malcolmus, or any of the police officers pursuing him, could he have done so?
Lothar de la Rey is one of the finest marksmen I have ever known. He could have killed all of us on more than one occasion, said Santaine.
I have no further questions, my lord, said Osmond. Judge Hawthorne wrote at length on the notepad before him, and then tapped his pencil thoughtfully upon the desk for another few seconds, before he looked up at the prosecutor.
"Do you wish to cross-examine the witness?" he asked.
The prosecutor came to his feet, scowling sulkily.
"I have no further questions for Mrs. Courtney."
He sat down again, folded his arms, and stared angrily at the revolving punka fan on the ceiling.
"Mrs. Courtney," said the judge, "the court is grateful to you for your further evidence. You may now return to your seat."
Santaine was so intent on searching the gallery for her son that she tripped on the steps at the foot of the tiers of benches, and both Blaine and Abby jumped up to help her. Abby reached her first, and Blaine sank back into his seat as Abby led Santaine to hers.
"Abby," she whispered urgently, "there was a lad in the gallery while I was giving evidence. Blonde, around 13 years old, though he looks more like 17. His name is Manfred, Manfred de la Rey. Find him. I want to speak to him."
"Now?" Abby looked surprised.
"Right now."
"The submission in mitigation. I'll miss it."
"Go," she snapped. "Find him."
And Abby jumped up, bowed to the bench, and hurried out of the courtroom, just as Mr. Reginald Osmond rose to his feet once again. Osmond spoke with passion and sincerity, using Santaine's evidence to full advantage and repeating her exact words. "He saved me from a dreadful death, and he saved my child with me." Osmond paused significantly and then went on. "The prisoner believed that he deserved the gratitude and generosity of Mrs. Courtney. He placed himself in her power by borrowing money from her, and he came to believe, mistakenly but genuinely, that his trust in her had been betrayed." His eloquent plea for mercy went on for almost half an hour. But Santaine found herself thinking of Manfred rather than the plight of his father. The look which the boy had levelled at her from the gallery troubled her deeply. The hatred in it had been a palpable thing, and it resuscitated her sense of guilt, a guilt which she believed she had buried so many years before.
"He will be alone now. He will need help," she thought. "I have to find him. I have to try and make it up to him in some way."
She realized then why she had so steadfastly denied the boy over all these years, why she had thought of him only as Lothar's bastard, why she had gone to extreme lengths to avoid any contact with him. Her instinct had been correct. Just a single glimpse of his face, and all the defenses which she had built up so carefully came tumbling down. All the natural feelings of a mother, which she had buried so deeply, were revived to overwhelm her.
"Find him for me, Abby,"
she whispered, and then realized that Reginald Osmond had completed his submission with a final plea. Lothar de la Rey felt that he had been grievously wronged. As a result, He committed a series of crimes which were abhorrent and indefensible. However, my lord, many of his actions prove that he was a decent and compassionate man, caught up in stormy emotions and events too powerful for him to resist. His sentence must be severe. Society demands that much. But I appeal to your lordship to show a little of the same Christian compassion that Mrs. Courtney has displayed here today, and to refrain from visiting upon this hapless man, who has already lost one of his limbs, the extreme penalty of the law.